A wet and windy middle of the week, October 9th outside. Inside, though, nice and dry here on Connecticut Today. We talked to a doctor who's written a new book about some of the ethical situations that maybe your doctor has to face every day and how he or she should handle them. We have new poll numbers, a bunch of them, from Quinnipiac, Sacred Heart, the Hartford Current, Reuters, all over the place about how folks in Connecticut and around the world are feeling with regarding to politics and impeachment. And also, Jim Calhoun, former UConn coach, named in a sexual discrimination suit of the University of St. Joseph. One of the comments that was made allegedly by his assistant coach had to do with Tinder, that app. I'm an old guy. I asked Aaron, my producer, to explain if he could Tinder to me.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And we are back here at WICC 600. Thanks for joining us. It's Connecticut Today for a midweek Wednesday. Stay inside, stay dry with us at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You know, we talked earlier in the show in anticipation of having our next guest on about the tough things that doctors have to do. We talk about a lot about medical topics on this show, whether a doctor has to tell you that, you know, a relative is terminal with an illness, or you may have terminal cancer, or someone doesn't survive an accident. Well, that's only half of it. A lot of doctors are faced with ethical questions. What to say when maybe things they find out are not as they were? A new book from a doctor, a guest of us right now, is going to delve into that. Our next guest teaches bioethics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, director of ethics, education, and psychiatry. He serves in that capacity as well, member of the Institutional Review Board. His essays have appeared all over the world, all over the country, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, the San Francisco Chronicle, Huffington Post, cable news as well. The name of the book is Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. Dr. Jacob Appel joins us. Dr. Paul here in Bridgeport, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
What made you write this? Was this the stuff that you have seen and heard and talked about over the years with yourself and with your compatriots in the medical practice?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I think the cases in the book are fascinating, not just for professionals, but for lay people. They're fun, they're interesting. They really are great ways to start an argument with your spouse. And on the other hand, they raise important ethical issues that people should really be thinking about, not just when their loved ones are sick, but more broadly, to be good citizens and to help further discourse on challenging topics.
It's fascinating. I've had some physicians in the family, both my regular family, my extended family through marriage doctor, and they always talk about ethics. They try to say that no matter what we do, cutting people open or psychotherapy or doing any sort of, you know, orthopedic work, we have to do what we do ethically. And various times in a career, even in the space of a week or a month in a practice, all physicians pretty much are faced with ethical decisions, who to tell what, how much of that to divulge. I know you say you teach courses in it, but how much can a doctor really prep for that before they are faced with some of the situations we'll talk about?
Sure. So there's no way to prep specifically for any particular case, but there are ways to think about the issues in advance. And what I tell people, the most important thing is to go into each situation with a very open mind, and to understand that there are rarely any right answers for the capital R. There are right answers for particular settings and particular patients.
All right, so let's talk about one you give here in the book, and there's a bunch of fascinating examples here. For example, you talk about a famous model who refused a C-section because obviously there is scarring there, no matter how cleanly it's done. What's the question there? What's the ethical conundrum there, doctor? If you have you're in a big city practice, and oh, look at this, I have this supermodel who comes here, but we have a real difference of opinion here as to how this baby should be delivered.
Well, there are two ethical questions, I think. One, even outside the issue of childbirth, is the question of to what degree we let people make decisions that may put themselves or others at risk that seem relatively unreasonable to us. So So someone who wants to not get treatment for an infection or turn off dialysis because they have a broken hand, we might say doesn't seem like a reasonable choice. But then I tell you they're a concert violinist and their career is over, that might shift your approach a bit.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's compounded because not only does the request, while important, seem unusual, it also imposes some consequence on fetal life in a potential baby, and the baby could die, or the baby could be born with severe disabilities as a result of not getting the C-section.
You give another example here, Dr. Appel, which is fascinating. Whether or not, how much to tell a patient if they are older, if they are elderly, or if they don't necessarily make all their medical decisions. And, you know, I kind of went through this with, you know, my elderly mother and father and aunt and an uncle. You give an example in the book saying about an immigrant and cancer. How would you describe that?
Sure. So every once in a while, an elderly patient with a serious illness like cancer we'll have a family member come forward and say, in our culture or our tradition, we don't tell our elders their bad news. Grandma wouldn't want to know she has cancer. And the challenge here is, in general, we do want to share information with people because that's what most people want. But if it's really what the patient doesn't want, you don't want to share it. If you ask your spouse over dinner, honey, if I were having an extramarital affair, would you want to know? The question will go over very badly because in asking the question, you reveal the answer.
Yeah.
So we can't just ask the patient, would you want to know? Instead, we do things like we'll get a family history, and I'll say, oh, your aunt died of cancer. That must have been hard for you.
Oh.
Did you tell her? And if the patient says, of course not, that would have killed her, that tells me a lot.
Interesting. So, but that must gnaw at you, doctor, in some way, because you know there's a serious diagnosis here, and there's really part of us, correct, that does not know whether that person might tell you, you don't know, but they might tell you, I'm glad you told me, what can we do about it? You see what I'm driving at here?
Absolutely. These are not easy questions, and you always have doubts whether you got it right. And I will add, it might matter whether there's something you can do or whether there's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
If there are decisions to be made about care, maybe it's more important to tell the patient. And in contrast, if the case is terminal anyway and there's nothing to be done, maybe you'd err on the side of not sharing. Of course, there are decisions to be made that aren't medical that might be just important. The patient might want to rewrite their will, for example.
Sure.
But you never really know.
And again, you're dealing here, doctor, so many of these dynamics, it must be tough when, in fact, as you cite, and I've seen in my personal life too, where it's not only the patient, there are brothers, sisters, kids, nieces, nephews, aunts involved, and you kind of have to wade through all of that, take a deep breath and say, okay, here are my options. What am I going to do here?
Absolutely. The real challenge is rarely deal with families who are acting outside the interest of a patient. Usually they're very well-intentioned, but they can't agree on what the interests of a patient are or what the patient would have wanted. So ideally, I tell people, bioethicists like myself are fun people to meet at weddings or bar mitzvahs, but you don't want to meet them in the hospital. The way to avoid that is to talk to your family long before you get sick.
In other words, the stories are really good. You can tell if you're getting up and down from the buffet table, is what you're saying.
Exactly. So I'm a fun person except in the hospital. In the hospital, you want to avoid me. And to avoid me, you got to talk to your relatives about what you would want done in different scenarios, what your values are. People think they know what their spouse's values are, but they very often don't.
Talking medical ethics, bioethics, some of the decisions that a practicing physician has to make that aren't that clear-cut. Not as simple as telling someone they have an infection, go home, take two of these, call me in the morning. Dr. Jacob Appel is the guest. Name of the book is Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. Dr. Appel, here in Connecticut, we're having a debate that's going on now in many states because of the unfortunate rise in spots. You know, we had one in Westchester County not too far from us, of outbreaks of diseases that we thought we had conquered, like measles and such. There's a debate going on here, doctor, as to forcing kids to undergo immunizations before they get into any sort of a local school system. And right now, doctor, they're reevaluating in the state here the efficacy and the allowance of what they call the medical objections to this, or a religious exemption to this. That must be a difficult situation when, say, somebody confronts a parent or talks to a parent about having to protect their child, yet the parent may be from a deeply religious background.
Absolutely. But it's important to distinguish those two cases, because people who doubt the efficacy of vaccination, that's a scientific question, whether vaccines work or they don't, and I believe they do. In contrast, people who understand vaccines may work, but they have a moral or religious objection, pose a much greater challenge, because it raises the issue of to what degree we impose our own collective will on innocent bystanders or people with deeply held beliefs in order to protect the public. The concern is not just for their own children, but also the risk that they will expose other children whose vaccines don't take or who can't get vaccinated to the illnesses that are at hand. At the extreme example, public quarantine, for example, the Typhoid Mary case, where you take people out of society, or Ebola or SARS, is a very extreme example of sacrificing individual liberty for the public good. This is somewhere on that continuum.
And it must be tough from a physician point of view, doctor, when you and your cohorts are trying to give as much information as you can on these things, trying to reason with these people. But I guess knowing where the point of no return is on this, and knowing how far you can state your case and then say, okay, wait a minute, I've done what I can ethically, now I've kind of got to back up.
Yeah, so I think it's important for all of us to remember that people who don't vaccinate their children don't do it for the most part because they love their children. They just start with different premises. And if you lose sight of that, if you view them as the enemy or not serving their children's interests, then you're never going to connect with them. I think the other issue that comes up is if they bring their children to your pediatric clinic, they may expose some of your other patients. To what degree do you have an obligation to share information about that risk with your other patients?
You cite an example in your book, Dr. Appel. The book is Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. You cite in your book something that's really kind of out of the headlines today. I could see this happening. A fertility clinic run by evangelical Christians that wouldn't, in a scenario, want to engage in vitro fertilization with a lesbian couple. Now, we've seen that in bakeries and other wedding services. What are your thoughts on that situation where a couple comes in, they're in love, and they say, listen, we want to have a child by insemination, but, you know, the doctor or the doctors that run that clinic are evangelical Christians?
Yeah, and this is based on a real case from California. And on the one hand, you might ask, well, what impact does this have on access to all people seeking reproductive services? But you also might ask, what impact does it have on lesbian couples? Because if this Christian doctor so deeply holds his or her beliefs that they won't offer services at all, then they just shut down their clinic. And not only might the general population have less access, but lesbian couples themselves might have less access. So it's not an easy answer again. Doctors are not like lawyers or barbers where they're an unlimited number as long as you qualify. They're more like liquor licenses or taxi medallions. Mm-hmm. So they're a precious resource.
One other thing you talk about in this book, and we'll use this as the final example here, you talk about the scenario of a daughter getting tested to see if she's a match to donate a kidney to her dad. They run the genetic test, and they find out, whoops, she's not the man's biological daughter. And I would imagine if this pops up, that's a real tough one to deal with.
Yeah, because on the one hand, sharing this information with the patient and the father might disrupt their family life, but not sharing it might lead the daughter to assume that she's not at risk for certain genetic diseases, not to get tested before she has children. And if you think that's easy, what if they're spouses and they discover not only are they matches, but they're related? Then do you tell them?
Wow. You know, Dr. Appel, this stuff to me, this must really, I would think in your profession, really gnaw at you. I mean, I can imagine being confronted with this thing and, yeah, you want to get the truth out. But as you say, it could rip a family apart. I mean, this could resonate not just with the patients you're talking to or caring for. You're talking 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 people in an extended family.
Yeah. I think all of these cases, they last with you, and The take-home message, I think, is there are no easy answers, and you just have to do your best, do the right thing, and hope you got it right.
Is there a scenario here, doctor, where you sit back and you say, well, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut? You know what I mean? And a lot of times that doesn't seem to be the gallant thing to do, but is sometimes not giving any of this information out the best road or not?
Oh, yes. In my experience, many patients and family members don't want an answer. They want help figuring out what they want and then permission to do it. So stepping back and letting them do something that reflects their own values, the ideal goal.
You know, I have a distant friend of mine I haven't seen in a long time, and it just kicked in my head when you were mentioning the daughter-father scenario here. This person, and you hear about this a lot in the news, doctor, these people who do these new genetic testing kits now, these Ancestry kits, Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and a lot of times they find out things that they, if they opt into a certain level of membership here, they find out they have relatives they didn't know about. They find out certain things about their background. And a lot of times, I read a feature story once, this forces them sometimes into counseling, into psychiatric counseling or genetic counseling. And I would imagine that's another ethical area that we're looking at now.
Yeah, once the genie's out of the bottle, it's hard to put it back in. I think a really concrete example, if you get tested for your risk for Alzheimer's disease, you also reveal the risk of your parents, whether they want to know it or not.
Wow, I did not know that. So you're saying that if a person goes, a son or daughter, gets tested for Alzheimer's disease, that would indicate mom and dad too?
So if they do testing for the APO gene, which is one of the major indicators of likelihood,
yeah,
they will often learn what the risk or the whether or not their parents have an elevated risk.
Wow.
And then they'll have this dilemma of whether or not to share it with their parents.
Wow. What is the goal here of your book? The name of the book, once again, Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. What do you hope people take out of this if and when they read it?
Well, I want people to think more deeply about these complex issues. But candidly, I think we approach ethics as a very serious, dismal field. I want people to actually realize it also can be fun and fascinating, and to take this book on road trips and discuss these issues with their families.
Interesting. Dr. Jacob Appel, who teaches bioethics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, widely researched and noted on this topic. Dr. Appel, thanks so much. We appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, there you go, folks. Here's the book if you want to check it out. There's some fascinating scenarios here. Fertility clinic run by evangelical Christians who don't want to impregnate a lesbian couple. A daughter gets tested to see if she's a match to donate a kidney to her dad. The doctor says, oops, you're not the kid. You're not the guy's daughter. Famous model doesn't want a C-section because it'll screw up her perfect body, but the kid may be in trouble if you deliver it the conventional way. Yikes. This is not a tomahawk. This is a foam WICC hammer. Hey, we're number one WICC hammer. I've got to save this, though. Hold on, I'm going to put this back there because it does somewhat resemble a tomahawk. All right, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Okay, polling numbers. We have a lot of new polls to talk about today. And yeah, there's polls out every day, but you know what? They're fun to look at. It's scoreboard watching. Every politician, whether it's, you know, people running for mayor in Bridgeport, people running for the General Assembly here in Connecticut, all over the place, saying, no, I don't pay attention to polls. Bull crap. Of course you pay attention to polls. New Quinnipiac University poll says 49% of Americans are opposed to impeachment, 45% want impeachment, and they want the president removed from office. 45 say impeach him and get him the hell out. 49% are opposed to it. Say, listen, and this was done, this is a recent poll. This was done recently. So it continues to split the country. We also have a new Sacred Heart University Hartford Curran poll on what's going on here in Connecticut. No big surprise here. Joe Biden, still the favorite of Democrats here in Connecticut, 37%. Elizabeth Warren at 14%, Bernie Sanders at 11%. Okay, I can buy that. When asked who they would vote for if the presidential race was between each of the individual candidates, the president doesn't do so well. There's a surprise in blue Connecticut. Joe Biden beats Donald Trump 52-33%. Bernie Sanders beats the president 51-35%. And Elizabeth Warren beats Donald Trump 49-35%. So the president only gets about one-third of the vote, if not less, here in Connecticut. 74% say they were somewhat aware of Medicare for All. About half, though, 47%, say they're concerned and saying they're either strongly or somewhat opposed to moving to a Medicare for All system. Those people are smart, ladies and gentlemen. Do I want people covered? Of course I do. Don't let the federal government, please, don't let them run health care. No. When asked whether or not college athletes should be allowed to earn income related to their athletic activities, similar to a bill passed in California, 53% say they strongly or somewhat support the Fair Pay to Play Act, allowing college athletes to earn money from endorsements. What could go wrong here? Really, honestly, what could go wrong? What could go wrong? Have some car dealer go up to these guys and say, hey, here's a Cadillac Escalade. You're 18 years old. Why don't you want that? You're going to be a one and done. So here's a nice Caddy Escalade for you. Not that it's a bad car. Love me my Cadillacs, but this has all type of things that could be abused. What else do we have here? I saw a couple of other things. Here, this is kind of interesting. New Reuters Ipsos poll. Man, the polls are flying like crazy. Get this. Most Democrats, if you folks are against the president out there, or a Democrat, did you catch this one? Listen to this. Seriously. Most Democrats want to impeach the president, even if that means weakening their party's chances of winning back the White House in 2020. Imagine that. They are so desperate to take him out. They want to do it now instead of trying it at the ballot box. The poll was conducted by Reuters and Ipsos on Monday and Tuesday, found that 55% of Democrats said that their party leaders should press ahead with impeachment, even if it means, quote, a lengthy and expensive process that could weaken their chances of winning the presidency in 2020. 66%, two-thirds, agree that Congress should pursue impeachment, quote, even if that means they will need to postpone efforts to pass laws that could benefit me. Well, there you go. They are so, and this is why a lot of people say to me, oh, Trump's going to win again. I said, don't bank on it, at least not yet. I said, you have to understand, a lot of Democrats are on a kamikaze mission here. They will sacrifice what might happen to them in the short term, or even maybe in the long term, to take this guy out. 55% say their party leader should press ahead with impeachment, even if it means a lengthy and expensive process that could weaken their chances of winning the presidency in 2020. Yikes. So they figure that, you know, it's all in now with them, all in. And here's my capper of the day. This one is just nifty. New survey out. Who did this one? The Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute is interesting. They're kind of like the centrist think tank in the country. If you know that, for example, the Heritage Foundation's on the right, and the Brookings Institution's on the left, the Cato Institute has been long kind of the libertarian, like, hands-off institute. This is frightening. And there is a frightening aspect to what I'm about to tell you. Americans under 30 are more likely to resent the ultra-rich and support violent acts against the wealthy. That's where we are. Again, this is not a far right-wing poll. This is not Fox News. This is not a poll from Red State. This is not a far left-wing poll. This is a poll from the Cato Institute. If you look at them online, they're kind of a centrist, third-way think tank. Americans under 30 are more likely to resent the ultra-rich and support violent acts against the wealthy. Americans under 30 are split evenly on their support of capitalism and socialism. A slim majority believes, man, this is dangerous. Now, here's where you get to the dangerous part here. A slim majority believes the rich earn their wealth by exploiting others. Man, you talk about stuff right out of Venezuela, right? You talk about stuff right out of Venezuela, Havana, Moscow. What is wrong with these people? 39% of those age 18 to 29 feel more resentment than admiration of rich people, compared to just 16% of those over 65. I have never in my life once resented a rich person. I don't understand that. I do not understand that. I never have. I still don't. I never will. Among the younger group, 44% said they felt angry when they read about the very rich. 35% said they thought citizens could be justified in taking violent actions against the rich. 30 years old and younger. What is wrong with these people? Get off your ass and get a job. You're worried about money? You really? Stop buying $5 coffees every day. That might do it. Stop trading in your freaking iPhone every 2 years.
The only afternoon show that talks about what's going on in your neighborhood. Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli. WICC 600.
WICC. In case you're just joining us, first of all, hope you've had a great day. This is Connecticut Today on WICC 600, and we are once again at 203-333-9422. Big story today all around the state. You know what? And I guess Jim Calhoun is as much of a sports icon in this state as you can have, I guess. A sex discrimination lawsuit against the University of St. Joseph alleges that Jim Calhoun and others in the athletic department involved in a boys' club behavior, or in boys' club behavior. This one from the Hartford Courant, this version here from the Hartford Courant. It's a former associate athletic director of the University of St. Joseph's, USJ, filing a federal lawsuit against the school alleging sex discrimination by former UConn coach Jim Calhoun and his longtime assistant Glenn Miller. The suit alleging disparaging comments the coach has made about her, including Jim Calhoun calling her hot. Come on, coach. A lawsuit filed Wednesday by Jacqueline Piscatelli against the university also names former athletic director Bill Cardarelli for failing to take action when she brought allegations against Calhoun to him and alleges that the former UConn basketball coach turned the athletic department into, quote, a male-dominated, hostile work environment for females. Piscatelli was fired from her job in June of this year, replaced by Josh Ingham, the sports information director, known as the SID. The university says it's reviewing the lawsuit. Calhoun says he has no comment. I'm sorry, the reason I'm laughing here is there's a section of this that, if it's true, you get... Coach, listen, with all due respect, there's certain things that you just, you can't say. That's, I guess that's all I can say. There are certain things, certain ways that you would conduct yourself around the office. And you know what happens sometimes, obviously? And I've kind of experienced this a little bit in my life. You have to remember that even if you're doing something you love to do, and particularly if it's in media or if it's in athletics or things like that, sometimes I think, not all the time, but sometimes there are certain people who, for whatever reason, and I don't think a lot of times it's malicious, but we work with people who would be offended, sometimes with good reason, with things that we say. And I think, is it being on guard? No, not necessarily, but this is why, honestly, you know, it's funny you would think for me saying this, but from what I'm doing now, flapping my gums for 4 hours, I generally don't say a lot to anybody else when I'm in the office. Maybe it's because I've got to, you know, conserve my energy a little bit, but, you know, there's a couple things I got to mention that are in this lawsuit that are going to make you go, ugh.
If you don't like what Paul has to say, tell him. 203-333-9422. Connecticut Today on WICC 600.
203-333-WICC, 333-WICC. Big story in the state today. All around, everybody's talking about this. Man, social media is burning up about this. Jim Calhoun, his assistant coach of the University of St. Joseph, Glenn Miller, being sued Title IX by a former associate athletic director at the school. So the person bringing the lawsuit here is Jacqueline Piscatelli, as we mentioned before the break here, former associate athletic director at St. Joe's. They eventually let her go. She says she was let go because she said things when she thought that Jim Calhoun and Glenn Miller were doing things that were not, you know, were not nice, you know, harassment and all this. So the athletic director that was in charge here, Mr. Bill Cardarelli, says here, according to the Hartford Courant, Cardarelli further asked Jacqueline Piscatelli, who Cardarelli was aware was not married, whether she would clean up after her husband in similar circumstances. This is after, I guess, Coach Calhoun had knocked over some K-cups. Well, that's not the more interesting part here. The lawsuit also said many times that Calhoun, and particularly Glenn Miller, used sexual innuendos when talking with her. Says the Courant here, on one occasion, she alleges that Calhoun made the comment, "Well, you're certainly hot." Okay, Coach, you can't. And again, this is all alleged, okay? None of this has been proven. We have to say that. But it's in print. It's on the air. We're going to tell you. Now, the lawsuit, and this is the thing that, like, a lot of young folks will understand. A lot of you folks in the audience, if you're a little older, you may not understand it. But I'm going to step back and get out of the line of fire, and Aaron will explain it to you. The lawsuit also alleges that Glenn Miller made numerous inappropriate comments, from criticizing her for not being cheerful or smiling enough to, on one occasion, telling her, quote, "I'd swipe left too." Aaron just lost it. That is a reference to the dating app Tinder. And Aaron, tell us about Tinder. I'm not saying you use it. But I
will admit that I did use Tinder when I was in college for a little while.
Okay,
not for long.
So when Glenn Miller looks at her and says, "Yeah, I'd swipe left too." If you swipe left on Tinder, that means what?
It means essentially yes. So basically the way that Tinder would work, it would just be, it's an app on your phone.
Yeah.
And I believe it's still there. And you would have a picture of random people in your area.
Yeah.
You know, whoever you're attracted to, whoever you want to date.
Yeah.
And if you find that person,
yeah.
attractive.
Now, if you swipe left.
You swipe left, it was down. No, yeah, it was down.
Yeah.
You swiped left, it was down. You swiped right, yeah. It was yes. Now, the whole way that the app worked was while you're here swiping and swiping left and right, yeah. Someone else is swiping left and right, and if you guys both swipe right on each other's pictures, you would get a match, and then you would be able to start to have a conversation
with that person. And let's put it this way, no matter what anybody's intentions are, how should we say this in a comfortable way? Tinder is not, how should I put this?
Not eHarmony.
Well, it's...
Let's put it to you that way. It's not eHarmony.
It's not that evangelical guy you say, hi, nope. I'm Dr. Neil Clark Warren.
Nope.
We've had 800,000 marriages. People who use Tinder is what you're saying, and I'm not reflecting on you. You're back in your college age. Tinder is not for long-term relationships.
No, it's not. It's absolutely not.
You're looking for something half an hour from now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Something, you know, in that time frame, you know, nothing serious, something very casual.
Casual. Coffee. Yeah. Coffee and biscuits.
That's what you want to call it. Something in between classes if you're in college. You
coffee
know,
and
something
biscuits.
Like that.
Yeah. The lawsuit also alleges that Glenn Miller made numerous inappropriate comments, from criticizing her for not being cheerful or smiling enough to, on one occasion, telling her, I'd swipe left, too. A reference to the dating app Tinder, in which users, as Aaron said, can swipe left to reject further contact with another user or swipe right to indicate asexual or romantic interest in the other user. Okay. Yeah, well, that is what it is. You know, it's look. This is all alleged. And the reason I keep saying that is simple. It's alleged. I mean, you and I, folks, we've all known some of these lawsuits. I knew of one a few years ago at another outlet that turned out to be nothing like was first alleged. But again, the only reason I'm talking about this is it's a big story. Jim Calhoun is about as close to coaching royalty as you can be in this state. I mean, he won 3 national titles at UConn. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's received numerous awards. But again, you got to remember, there's always two sides to this. And look, you and I, and if you want to weigh in on this, you can. I want to hear from you at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You and I have all been in work environments, right, where there are, and the only reason I'm saying this from the point of view that I am is simply because of how the lawsuits are filed. If you are a guy, and not just a, but bear with me for this, you know what I'm saying here. If you're a guy and you associate with several female coworkers, you guys know that there are some female coworkers where you can say just about anything and they laugh. They'll never tell you, this bothers me, please don't say that. They don't come up to you and say, you know, whatever, you know, I know you were trying to make a joke, but that's kind of an uncomfortable thing for me. And you would say, okay, I'm sorry, never again, I didn't mean any harm, and everything's fine. You have, you know, women, and I've encountered this in other operations where, you know, you can say one thing to one person. And again, it's usually men to women, not often women to men. It's not all. It does happen. Don't get me wrong. It's not often, though, if you look at the raw numbers, where a woman makes a guy feel uncomfortable. It does happen. I get it. But you have scenarios where you have guys say stuff to a woman that may be innocent, and you may think it's just part of workplace banter. And, well, she said that to me. I'm going to say that back to her. And it turns out to be a big problem. Then you also, right, guys, you work with some women who, you know, they may say something to you, and you're like, whoa, wow, I haven't heard that since I was in the Marines.
You know what I mean? It's everybody needs to, here's the bottom line, everybody needs to behave in the workplace. So we'll put this story up at WICC600.com. You can leave your thoughts there. What do you think, Jim Calhoun? Is Coach in trouble with this, or maybe he's going to argue that it was all kind, it was all done in fun.